Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We've talked with past guests about certain locations that are known for excessive paranormal activity. Edinburgh, Scotland is one of those areas. Our guest, author, ufologist, photographer, and musician Andrew Hennessy has written about it in his recent book titled Alien Encounters and the Paranormal. Abductions, men in black, spacecraft at treetop level, apparitions in the sky, and glowing monsters leaping out of holes and underground caverns are some of the items we'll discuss in this show. Andrew Hennessy has been writing and investigating the paranormal for decades in Scotland, and he explains how some of these strange occurrences cross over into Scottish folklore. Andrew's earlier book, Monkeys of Eden, describes a world of high strangeness, not unlike the premise of films such as They Live or the short story, 10 O'Clock People. We save most of that for the second hour. In this hour, we begin with a brief background on Andrew and what odd experiences have led him into this realm of research. Andrew Hennessy, welcome to Another News.
Thanks very much.
Andrew, you're involved in a lot of projects in Edinburgh, Scotland, from UFO skywatches to paranormal walking tours. I've been reading your recent book, Alien Encounters and the Paranormal, and now I really want to visit some of the churches and castles in Scotland. Scottish folklore and the paranormal overlap in a lot of areas, and you discuss that overlap in your investigative work and writings, which is something I enjoy because it reveals the legacy of these experiences people have had throughout generations, going way, way back. If you would, could you tell listeners some of your background in how you began to explore and write about the paranormal world in Scotland and Scottish folklore?
When I was younger, I was introduced to paranormal issues from my parents. My mother had the gift of the second sight and seemed to bring all sorts of alternative visions and explanations to things that were going on. And I remember throughout my childhood, you know, having visions or encounters and stuff like that. These are things that I wouldn't initially identify as non-human or of a non-human nature, because as a child, it would influence my play behavior. I would play with the colonel in the apple tree, say, or he would oversee my games of soldiers in the back garden and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that sort of developed later on, and I used to perceive lots of creatures and beings and things like that. I suppose I inherited that gift from my mother.
What types would you see?
I think you would see the sort of variety of beings that you might find described in something like Grimm's Teutonic mythology, where there are kobolds and goblins and fairies and elves and gnomes, and there's a whole kind of encyclopedia of little creatures which centuries of folklore of kind of and witness accounts have supplied us with descriptions of this phenomenon. And I say phenomenon because it isn't until later on in your life that you realize that, well, maybe you're not seeing what you think you're seeing. And that was for my more mature years. I would start to analyze what I really was seeing and noticing the similarities and noticing the differences.
Now, if you grew up in the middle of Nebraska somewhere, you might have had a different experience, but there's something very interesting about the area that you grew up in. So you had a couple things happening at once, the second sight plus the mysterious area that you grew up in. What is it about that area?
The Edinburgh area has got historical connections and ancient connections and mythological connections to the underworld, basically. I mean, you've got the Lothians, and very much Lord of the Rings was actually modelled on that part of Scotland. And there's quite a lot of connections and tie-ins between the Lord of the Rings and the actual book itself written by J.R.R. Tolkien, and many of the historic events and people from Scottish mythology. And you've got like the Lothians of Scotland, that's the Lothlorien. Quite a lot of abductions were taking place in the Lothians, and ufology and some of Scotland's most famous abductions took place in the middle of that sort of golden circle. And in fact, there were a lot of lottery wins taking place in that area too, as well as being a UFO triangle from Bonnybridge to you know, East Lothian, West Lothian, and all that. The whole area had a history of interaction with paranormal creatures, and I think this has got to do with, largely got to do with the underground scenario in that area, the caverns, cavern systems, goblin. There's places called Goblin Halls in the Lothians. There's little villages called Elphinstone and all that sort of thing. The whole area is absolutely steeped in all the mythology that Hollywood now sort of makes movies about. And it really was and still is today happening in that part of Scotland.
Yeah, I want to get into the underground aspect of it a bit later. But yes, there is the cinematic references and portrayals. I really enjoy the realness of your videos and other people's videos when you're examining the landscape. And in some of the videos on your channel, it's under the name of your name, Andrew Hennessy. I was interested in your investigations around the Gorebridge area, Scotland, that are being used for, you mentioned, spacecraft landing and taking off. I love that idea. There are some other people on YouTube that have a similar hypothesis. His channel is named Joe Blogs in the UK. And he took his videos down for some reason, but he was on to a very similar thing that you had done, you know, many years before. It's that following up on what seems to be impossible, but the more you investigate with a true effort, more information reveals itself. Can you tell us about that area of research where spacecraft could be landing and taking off in nearby fields?
Yes, the Gorebridge phenomenon, it is a window area, and multiple witnesses. There was one incident just a few years ago where 40 black spheres that glowed orange as well, but they were black spheres, went flying in formation at rooftop height down Barleynow Road in Gorebridge, and everyone was out of their houses, out of their, and you know, they were extremely disturbed by this event. But people will go walking up to a local hill called a camp, a Roman camp. It was an old hill, but it's also an old disused coal mine as well, open cast coal mine. And they will see things, they'll see lights, they'll see beings, they'll see people. Some very strange things are going on. There have been creatures filmed padding about on people's roofs. And, you know, there was a gentleman has been filming this phenomenon, is John Gillies of Gorebridge, and he has a channel on YouTube called Skywatcher Scotland, and he's filmed a lot of stuff on his own rooftop. He's seen a lot of stuff, and he was targeted by this man in black scenario called Colonel Joe, and it really was the archetypal authority figure in the old black Bentley car. You know, and he was getting phone calls. He was saying, come and meet me, and all this sort of stuff. And John Gillies would go out walking with his dog, and then the colonel would pull up in a car, take out a bit of technology, put the technology on his hood and say, don't worry, this is counter-surveillance technology. And then he would show him maps from the 1950s and, tell him things. I thought, well, as soon as I heard this story, I thought, well, I'll just go out there and check that for myself. And I went out, and I did indeed, on the road that goes across that hilltop, I saw Colonel Joe in his black Bentley with his grey tweed suit and all that stuff. I mean, there is this stuff going on. I went and got a hold of John Gillies, the cameraman who's filming UFOs, black helicopters, beings hopping about his roof and in his house as well. I went out and got hold of John Gillies. I thought, well, let's go and drive about. And we were followed by this black 4x4. And then it went past us, and in it were two kind of middle-aged, besuited figures. And it went up the road in front of us, and it turned, and it came back down. And then you had the two people in the vehicle had suddenly become two young guys in, you know, sort of casual clothes that had undergone a transformation. Hmm. And it's, the thing is that John Gillies is filming ships taking off from that local area. There are domed, he's got footage of domed craft taking off, and apparently the locals are saying the fields light up at night. He's got gantries, he's got low-flying stuff there, and this is quite extraordinary, just what seems to be going on. And it's not just witnessed by this one person, it's a multiple witnesses. I think the locals are maybe a little bit shy of coming forward, just because the whole thing's very terrifying. I mean, for instance, the black globes I was telling you about, after terrorizing the people in Barley Now Road, they then went up in the general direction of the primary school and settled on the roof there. So I'd imagine that the locals would be a bit concerned that these strangely piloted vehicles were landing on their school roof. So It just, you know, the whole area for the last 10 years anyway has been like this. And when I went to investigating the Gorebridge situation, I discovered that it's got far older roots than just the last 10 years. I mean, it goes back decades, and then the more you dig, the more you find the fairy stories, the fables of the creatures in the hills, in the hillside, stories of the fairy parades. And the fairy parade is when, under the full moon, the fairy people will come out and in a little procession, and they'll wear all their best clothes. In the 1970s, near Crichton Castle, that's not very far from Gorebridge, where two young men had decided to go into the local churchyard, and they witnessed a fairy parade. And in Scottish tradition, the fairy parade usually have knights in shining armour and ladies and damsels in evening dress with pointy hats on and all that sort of stuff. And that's the typical fairy parade of courtly vision of times gone by. But the fairy parade they witnessed was of gentlemen and ladies in evening suits and evening wear. So the fairy parade had adapted itself to that generation and had become the impressive archetype of the day, you know. So the 1970s evening suits and all that sort of stuff. If they'd been there in the 15th century, they would have seen perhaps knights in shining armour or on horses and stuff like that. But so the area's got connections to fairy lore, UFOs, strange creatures hopping about the fields and all that sort of thing. Most of that is being filmed by John Gillies. As I say, he's got quite a lot of footage on YouTube. And I have some of his footage on my channel too. The kind of things that he's filming flying over include things that were seen at the International Space Station, a UFO of similar type. It looked like the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, actually. It was quite incredible, some of the stuff seen.
Oh, yeah, I'll have to check out his channel. Is it primarily daytime footage or night vision?
No, you get daytime, nighttime stuff too. When I go to Gorebridge, I can go there any time of the day, and you can just, as long as you take plenty of photos, you don't immediately see everything, because the stuff that's floating about the size of a washing machine, they're UAVs, and they're about 6 foot by 6 foot or something like that. And you'll not necessarily see them immediately with the naked eye against the trees, because they sort of camouflage by hovering at treetop level. But they glow, and then they become invisible. And I have a picture of a goose, I think it's a grey lag goose, with a 6 foot wingspan, challenging one of these things. I don't know what happened to the goose. Hopefully it got away okay, but these things are flying about. They're like little surveillance machines. I always thought that with so much activity in the Gorebridge area, there has to be some sort of alien base in that area. There has to be something along those lines in that area. Maybe in that 10 square mile area, there has to be something you know, very interesting indeed going on there. And there have been so many stories of craft taking off from the field. We've got some images of cattle mutilation. And there have been stories of abductions and of people. The Dalhousie Castle abduction, lady was heading off to work at 4:30 in the morning. Dalhousie Castle abduction was in, I think it's 2008. I can't remember exactly, but I think it's 2008. Dalhousie Castle abduction, December the 3rd, 2007. December 2007, lady heads off to work and she's come up the traffic lights at this bridge at Dalhousie Castle. The lights go out, her car engine dies, she gets out her car, and overhead is this big craft with lots of little lights around it. And as she's standing there, another car pulls up beside her, and a young gentleman gets out of the car, picks up his mobile phone dies. He realizes he's in a lot of trouble because his own car engine and everything electronic he's got is suddenly stalled. He sees this lady, goes across to the lady, and the pair of them are hovering in the air, and there's a craft overhead and all that. And he had this terrifying idea that people from the Dalhousie Castle area were out to get him. He suddenly had this, I don't know where he got the idea from, but he had that idea. And this, what's interesting about this particular abduction is that these two people, independent of each other, worked at the same industrial estate and not very far from there. I don't know quite what the connection is, but it's quite near the Roslyn area, you know? So it's quite an interesting thing, that particular abduction, because in that same area there have been images of craft taking off from the fields and stuff like that, so... And not very far from there, people are saying that the fields light up. And I've personally gone to that area. It's between Dalhousie Castle and Carrington. You guys will have to get the Google Earth thing out and have a look at this. But I think that between Dalhousie Castle and the village of Carrington, there's all these fields. I've gone there, I've taken images of stuff parked in fields, little UFOs, strange-looking things, devices floating about, little UFOs, and some very strange machinery that looks like it came out of that H.G. Wells time traveler movie as well. Some very strange looking device in the fields. And what I've noticed about this stuff is it has a sort of stealth camouflage on it. Obviously not that stealthy if I'm seeing it, of course, but mm-hmm. in a certain light, say at twilight, it doesn't quite pick up the background. It's like a conical kind of field or stealth field over it, and it picks up all the local environment, and it makes it into a sort of artificial-looking image which sits over the person or the ship. So I've seen them about 3 feet tall or 30 feet tall, depending on what or more, depending on the size of the thing that they're concealing. It seems to be some sort of technology in use there. But, I mean, I know that, for instance, that even the... information disclosed to the public about the US research about camouflage and stuff showing, shining through the stuff behind to make it appear that there's nothing actually there.
That's,
I mean,
right.
Mm-hmm. This sort of thing is being seen at Gorebridge. There was a guy out walking and he could see, he was near that hilltop the on the Roman fort I was telling you about. He was near the hilltop there and he could see somehow that horizon had been amplified in front of him, and it just looked very odd to him that somehow the perspective was all wrong. So this is the same John Gillies that's filming the local hillsides at sunset, and shining through the rays of the setting sun are shining through and behind some of the stuff that's parked on the hills, and he has images of this big black triangle which the rays of the setting sun are shining through its camouflage. So obviously, if these beings are giving technology to our governments, then the technology isn't all that great.
Right. I know what you mean by that. I wanted to ask you, Andrew, this is you mentioned it was a 10 square mile area of activity. What do you think is going on there?
Well, it could be, well, according to the local member of parliament at the time, There was nothing much going on there, but well, we tried to get some sort of public inquiry as to the nature of the land use, and in the UK you're not supposed to fly under 500 feet if it was a military or a military industrial complex, or if something like that was going on, then obviously it's not necessarily in the public interest to be asking these questions even. But the thing is, if it's a non-human thing that's going on, then it's been going on for generations there. And it might well be that the military are somehow involved these days as well. Certainly, sometimes before the activity happens, you'll hear this noise of some military jet or some military equipment, and then shortly after that, you'll see this silent. It looks like a jet aircraft, but it's probably really a hologram or something. I mean, the thing is, we're very difficult to find out what's going on in that area, even though you can see things on people's roofs. You can photograph strange-looking things on people's roofs there, and devices, or they look like, I don't know quite what they look like. They're not exactly satellite aerials. So, but there is stuff on people's roofs, and there's stuff driving about that looks like vehicles, but they're not really vehicles as well. I have some images of a shape-shifting car as well, a car, wow. Shifting its shape. So, but this kind of phenomenon is associated with the fairy lore, because in centuries gone by, fairy chariots would change shape and all that sort of thing, flying shields, and you'd always get stuff flying about that changed its appearance. And this is characteristic not only of UFO lore, of the modern UFOs, but of the fairy stories in that area as well.
It reminds me of John Keel's work, his book Operation Trojan Horse. He mentions how the UFOs would take on the latest human technology that's flying around in the air, such as blimps and now aircraft and jets. And we've had on some people in past shows talk about the phenomena of fake planes, especially at night, where you can't really tell the actual shape of the craft, but you can see the lights begin to change formation in mid-flight, and which is impossible for a fixed wing aircraft. And there's a woman in Toronto who we had on the show. She is filming these planes that she says aren't real planes, and she's seeing them at night, but they're also following her around. It's just another example. Andrew, could you talk a bit more about the crossover there of the fairy folklore and maybe what's piloting these crafts?
Well, I think that today's UFO euphonauts are really just fairies in silver suits, and that if you look back at all this phenomenon throughout the millennia, it's always malignantly behaving, it's always abducting, it's always replacing people or replacing objects. It's the same phenomenon. It was demonic millennia ago. It was the fairies, the djinn, the kobolds, or whatever you want to call it today. And then now it's UFOs. Now it's Zeta Reticulans from the planet Demon or whatever it is. I think that a good example to bear in mind is, from my point of view, about this phenomenon, is that in Scotland, round about the year 2000, there was a collective of people in a town called Kirkcaldy who were numerous people. They all had digital cameras. They were photographing lights that would follow them about. And they wouldn't just be lights. They'd be some beautiful-looking lights. They'd be blue iridescent, or they'd be white or pearly white, or they'd be following them about. And so the gentleman took a very biblical perspective on this and said, well, the prophet Elijah was returning, and that kind of thing. And he would call these things the perils of great price. And if anybody did anything wrong, then these perils of great price would then cause calamities to happen to whoever stood in the way, sort of thing.
Wow.
So people would end up with broken legs or stuff like that. Accidents would happen. This contact collective was photographing all sorts of manifestations in their own back gardens, their own backyards. They looked like glowing orbs. What happened with myself was that I was asked to comment on a particular photo that they'd taken. Now, they photographed something that looked like what he said was the prophet Elijah holding a book. And in fact, it just looked to me like an insectoid creature with a ray gun. That's what it looked like to me. But anyway, what happened? I had a little split with them because I felt I couldn't actually, you know, go along with what they were saying. For instance, the prophet Elijah, according to the Christian text, had already been and gone. So obviously the prophet Elijah is not coming back a third or fourth time. So at the end of the day, though, they were photographing this stuff at night. Now, one of the gentlemen started filming one of these orbs, these glowing lights, pearls of great price, as they were calling them, and then he followed it out into the middle of the estuary called the Firth of Forth. So you see there's Kirkcaldy to the north and there's Edinburgh to the south, across this estuary called, it's the Celtic for the Firth of Forth means way of ways, apparently. But anyway, across this estuary, he filmed this little glowing light, and then suddenly his camera's fixed onto this 3-mile-long starship hovering at about 500 feet or 1,000, under 1,000 feet, definitely, 3-mile-long. And it had an elliptical starship. And for 2 hours, he filmed it for 2 hours. There were little glowing objects flying out of its decks. It was like something like Battlestar Galactica, you know, with the little stuff coming out of its decks. And mm-hmm. there was like a swarm of these little glowing ships were rising and falling and heading over into the Edinburgh area. Hours of that. Now, I've seen the footage, and it was definitely a big, it looked something out of Star Wars. Like he would have been today accused of CGI, except that the thing is that it wasn't. And at that point, something started happening to the cameraman. He started getting followed about. Strange people right. would then come to his door. And one night, he was staying alone, and he saw this silently flying RAF surveillance plane. It was called a Nimrod, but it was gliding. It would make no noise. It had no lights. It was just gliding. And this black vehicle with archetypal men in black Air Force figures at his door and all that. He got so terrified by all this stuff that he handed it all in to the local mental hospital.
That's not good.
Not good. It wasn't a good thing that he did that, unfortunately. But all that footage and all the images that he had got lost.
Was it day footage or night?
Nighttime footage, but it was very clear.
I was going to ask.
It was a 3-mile-long ship. And 3 miles.
You saw this, so it was.
I've seen it. Yeah, I showed it to other people at the MIMAC film festival in Glenrothes around the year 2000. So other people have seen this. So it's not just a figment of my imagination.
What do you think is going on, in your opinion, with the men in black, especially in your area?
Well, I think that the men in black situation is about the greys or the fairies or whatever you want. The greys or the fairies, I think, are one and the same thing. What they do is they manifest things that authority figures that you would be afraid of. And I think that the man in black thing is part of that tradition. Black Knight on the road in medieval times in England, it was the Black Knight on the road. And you see these authority figures. Like in Gorbridge recently, it was Colonel Joe, and he wasn't wearing black; he was wearing a grey tweed suit. But it was in the UK, the grey tweed suit and authoritative-looking figure, you know, that sort of thing. The greys manifest these. I think they're holograms, and that the greys manifest these to terrorise us and put us in our place, sort of thing. They overawe us, overpower us with these visions of these frightening visions.
And keep up with the fashion of the time.
And keep up with the fashion of the time, yes.
Our guest is Andrew Hennessy. We're talking about his book, Alien Encounters and the Paranormal. We'll continue after the break. If you've just tuned in, Andrew Hennessy is our guest, and we're talking about strange creatures and UFOs in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland. There are some breathtaking views in Scotland and beautiful cathedrals and castles on top of cliffs, on islands in the middle of lakes, massive stone structures built on top of rocky outcroppings and mountains barely accessible to people. Some of these castles, as you pointed out, are built over areas of gateways to significant underground tunnel systems, caverns, and labyrinths. There's a fascinating story that you relayed in your writings about a particular castle that led into and behind certain areas of a city. Can you describe that story for listeners?
The story relates to Edinburgh Castle. Edinburgh Castle sits on a rock, and the castle rock, occasionally subject to weathering, will crack open and because it's a military thing. There's a wee military underground communications bunker in there as well. So because it's the tradesmen they would get in to patch it up would be ex-military. But on this occasion, the two guys had been phoned to come and brick up this crack that appeared in Edinburgh Castle Rock. It was so big that the two of them decided to go through the castle rock entrance, and they had a wander around inside these passageways. They got behind the officers' mess. They could see Princes Street, the iconic Scottish street below, and they had were wandering around, and suddenly they came to this big drop in front of them, the big cavern. They could feel the air coming up, and they thought, well, goodness, this is some big, deep drop in the castle rock. So they picked up a stone and they dropped it. Mm-hmm. And then very suddenly, they didn't actually hear the stone hit the bottom, but they suddenly realized that they could hear stuff happening down there. Something very close to them happening. There was scurrying or something. And then suddenly up comes this big green glowing reptilian creature, and the pair of them were terrified, and they went running and running. It chased them through the corridors and back out into Johnson Terrace. And they were so terrified that they had to take time off work, and they came to the Theosophical Society in Edinburgh because they were very disturbed about what they'd seen.
I bet.
It wasn't anything like they'd ever. It was like something out of a horror story or a B movie.
They're lucky to be alive.
And met that. Yes, and the thing about that story is that the underground scenario in the Edinburgh area, you've got all these chambers and caverns going down, down and down, ancient brickwork that is older than the city itself, actually, under Edinburgh, as it has been noted. There is tunnels and caverns which are more modern, I mean, 18th century. And I think there's a story of the cavern system under where the Scottish Parliament now is, and that comes out at a place called Calton Hill, just above the Scottish Parliament and all that. And Calton Hill is a fairy hill where all the fairies used to hang out. These are beings, they're supernatural beings, used to hang out there. And a gentleman in the 18th century called Captain Burton discovered this boy that would go and play the drum at these gatherings, which were reputed to be full of treasure and riches and stuff like that, and everybody wanted to get in to the best party in the town. And he made prisoner of this boy, this otherworldly being, who actually escaped him, but not before he told the captain that there were caverns under Edinburgh that you could fit in the whole of Scotland to.
Oh my God.
Everyone in Scotland could stay in the caverns under Edinburgh.
That sounds like what Dr. Carmen Bolter has found under a pyramid in Egypt, about 160 feet down into the ground. It's about 107 acres down there.
The folklore from Campbell, Superstitions of the Western Isles, and I think you might find this reference elsewhere as well, if you look at sacredtexts.org, I think it is. they refer to the blue men of the Minches, and these are aquatic reptilian beings called the Draco. And just keeping on the theme blue, in the western, the Minches are underwater tracks between the western islands of Scotland. And in that vein, as it were, these blue bloods, blue men or blue creatures or whatever, these reptilian creatures, their symbolism, their snake symbolism, is carved all over the ancient stones of Scotland. And there are little tunnels that connect all these ancient stone sites. And these have been recently discovered all over Europe, in fact. And the tunnels are not very high. You'd have to be a four-foot being to be running up and down these tunnels, because they're not very high. You'd have to crawl along them if you're human. So anyway, this stuff is going on. The Blue Men of the Minches, reptilian Draco, and you'll find that in all the lore, folklore. Now, my own particular encounter with the Draco of the Western Isles is quite an interesting story. That I was playing in 1997 at this band, a Scottish dance band, and we were on the east side of Scotland, which is about 200 miles from where we were asked to travel. So not that far, really, in American terms, but Scottish terms, we were the closest city to this area of activity I'm going to describe was Glasgow. And it's a thriving music scene, but for some reason they bypassed everybody in Glasgow and they phoned us in Edinburgh. I was staying in Edinburgh at the time. Mm-hmm. And they got our band. I said, well, I explained to them, well, we're going to have to charge you a lot for our petrol and all that, because it's quite a long hike to get over there down to Campbellton. Paul McCartney of Wings wrote a song about that, Mull of Kintyre. Oh, mist rolling in from the sea, etc. His desire was always to be there, etc. So anyway, we took the drive down to Mull of Kintyre, and it was a wicker man country. It was fishing nets, all very picturesque. And we arrive at this village, and there's a big house, and there's a village. We were playing in the wee village hall next to the big house and all that sort of things. So we were playing for our dancing. Playing away or dancing. I noticed while we're playing for the Scottish dance music, there's this tall, young, black-haired lady watching the band and watching me as well. I thought, oh my goodness. So at half-time, when we stopped for our break, we went over to the buffet, where in Scotland it's usually pastries and baked goods and stuff. Mm-hmm. For some reason, this buffet was very, very fishy. It had herring, it had shellfish. It was the most. It looked like it just come out of the ocean. To be honest, it didn't look that appetizing to the ordinary person. To be honest, mm-hmm. It looked terrible. It was one of the worst buffets I've ever seen in my life. There were little bits of fish rolled up, stuck with it. It was horrible. So anyway, I'm standing at this buffet, wondering if I should eat anything. Never mind if I could. And along comes this lady with young lady with the black hair, you know, an alluring young lady and all that sort of stuff. Having this conversation, she's saying, well, in this part of Scotland, the fishwives suck the bone from the herring. Because I'm looking at the herring, it looks very, very interesting. But, I mean, I don't know what they've done with the fish, but it just... Anyway, mm-hmm. Along comes this older lady, and well-dressed older lady, stands beside the young lady. They have a quick conversation and say, you know, exchange niceties. And then the young lady looks at me and then turns to the older lady and says, Mama, I've never seen anyone like that before. Can I keep him? And I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of out of the equation here. Am I a parakeet or what could I possibly be? The thing that struck me later was Mama looked at me and I looked at Mama. I just said, not a chance. I'm thinking to myself, you know, as you do, no way. Mm-hmm. But suppose in days of yore, Mama had said yes. I mean, might there be a dearth of Scottish dance bands in the Glasgow area or something? I'm not really sure, but anyway, thankfully, Mama said no, which is good, and we carried on with the Scottish dance, and then we kind of slept an uneasy night, and then we headed back to Edinburgh the next morning. I'll tell you, the road going out of that area was so many windy. It was winding around all these forest roads, you know. It just, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was glad to get home, needless to say. But I wasn't kept in the Mullaghcleugh tyre, which is good.
What do you think that was about?
It just could have been some kind of human, non-human encounter, or yeah. It just could have been... It didn't seem to be joking. They weren't joking.
Right, I gotcha. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. You're a stray cat or something, but, you know... I don't know. That there's a lot of familial bloodlines that go way back in certain areas of Scotland that have connections to maybe Atlantis, some would argue. And
yes.
Tell me about evidence or research that you've come across in regard to that.
Well, there's two kinds of evidence for the Atlantean scenario in Scotland. One is the mythological, and the other one is the archaeological. The mythology can be found in things like the Irish, the Celtic Book of Invasions, where the Tuatha De Danann, which are the kind of reptilian, the reptilian people, they came across from a far distant land, wherever that might be, or wherever it was they had fallen from. And just like the elves of in Lord of the Rings and all that, how they, the men of old, they came across and they brought with them four mighty artifacts: the spear, the cup, the Stone of Destiny, and the cauldron of Dagda as well. They had these artifacts, and that's in the mythology. And that what happened was that these men of renown, or their descendants, were the men of renown. It all seems to be very biblical, this as well, for some reason, that they were creatures of these giant knights have been dug up in Southern Ireland in graves, you know, big giant Irish knights and all that sort of stuff. So the Tuatha De Danann, people of Danu, and that's the Anunnaki basically, you know, so the Anunnaki have this history of Celtic culture. Seems to come from them very much. A Scottish painter called John Duncan has a very interesting painting of this called The Riders of the She, and she is spelt S-I-D-H-E, and you see these elegant kind of people on horses with snake helmets and all that stuff. So if you look at the Book of Invasions, you'll discover that there's an interaction of this bloodline, the Anunnaki bloodline. The same people that came to Sumeria also came to Ireland as well, so the people of the Danu. Now, the archaeological evidence for it all is that in and around Scotland, there are at least 60 places in Scotland where forts, you know, hill forts, have been vitrified, melted down into glass lumps. Now, that's the same sort of thing that you get in the Indian culture, the Vedic culture, the Mahabharat, where you've got the Vimanas, the flying saucers flying about, unleashing the power of the sun on stuff. And interestingly enough, one of the Anunnaki artifacts, which the Irish are supposed to have had, was the Spear of Lu, which was a kind of big, a kind of laser blaster that could fry things. And so it does seem that from the lore, that the Irish version of the reptilian Anunnaki is the same sort of Anunnaki that were in the Middle East, Mesopotamia. The Anunnaki in Ireland lost a big battle, apparently, and they were banished underground. Well, I mean, underground in anywhere in on planet Earth, as we know, is, I mean, planet Earth is full of underground reptilian stories from the Naga of under Tibet and all that stuff, and to even Ireland, you'll get stories of these creatures, and it might be that the blue men of the Minches and this blue-blooded reptilian idea is all part of you know, the Atlantean fall mentioned in the Book of Enoch or Josephus's Antiquaries of the Jews, the Fallen Angels, and all that sort of stuff. It's a big tie-in in Celtic lore, I think.
Yeah, you've done a lot of research on this, Andrew, and I'm fascinated by reading some of your material. A past guest, Dr. Carmen Bolter, who produced the five-part documentary series, The Pyramid Code, talks about the ancient dynasties of Egypt and how initiates and adepts in certain dynasties had 360 senses. They could hear color and they could see sound. Their genetic structure was fully functional. In a past book that you wrote titled Monkeys of Eden, you mentioned that there are humans living today with fully functional DNA and complete telepathy. Can you tell listeners about this?
Yeah, I have a story. When I tell this, the title of this particular story is How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it's a story of a young lady and her boyfriend from, I'll just call her Anna, from Lithuania, Eastern Europe anyway. Mm-hmm. But Anna, story of Anna, how I met Anna was that we were involved with our musical projects, we're involved in theatre, and I was working with people who could spontaneously generate scripts in theatre, and I was spontaneously generating the music to go with it and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we met Anna, who's a very theatrical young lady, again, tall, long black hair, attractive, etc., etc. Now, I got invited to Anna's dinner party. I didn't realize it happened to be the night of a full moon, by the way, but I don't know if that had that much to do with it. But when I rang the doorbell, her boyfriend answered the sort of bell and you know, through the intercom said, well, in his best Count Dracula accent, he says, welcome, Andalus. Welcome, Andalus, he says in his best Count Dracula accent, imitation, you know, just a joke. So mm-hmm. Went upstairs, went to the bathroom, noticed the little plastic snakes and all the snaky Egyptian stuff in the bathroom and all that, which is fair enough. And then we had a dinner and we were discussing about traveling as a theatre group, etc., which is interesting. But you know, anyway, so Anna beckons me to come through to this room. So I follow Anna through. And so Anna kneels in the carpet in front of me, about 10 feet away, and I'm indicates that I should kneel down and face her. So we're 10 feet away. There's no way we couldn't touch each other. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, my brain is hit with the most intense feeling of ecstatic feeling, intense feeling of the most ecstatic. It was flooded out. My nervous system could barely cope with that. And she did that three times with exactly the same intensity. So I would know. Mm-hmm. Now, someone that could do that to a human being, now just think if you meet somebody and say, well, listen, do you really want to sell your house for $40? It's a big house, but, and then and just tickle their pleasure centers just slightly, you'd be up for selling your house to anyone for $40 if they had that ability, wouldn't you?
Good point. Yes, I know what you mean. It's happened once before. I didn't know what was going on, but I've encountered something similar, but not quite as dramatic.
I didn't sell my house, by the way. But you see, I was very lucky to have been protected. You know, that's the thing about myself. I've survived an awful lot of weird encounters. I actually became Christian in 2006. Just to say thanks very much to all the saints and angels that had to be looking after me, because I've survived some pretty weird stuff.
Well, in your book titled Monkeys of Eden, it's a fascinating read. It touches on so many areas, including the premise of the movie They Live, based on the book 8 o'clock in the Morning by Ray Nelson. And just recently, Andrew, I read Stephen King's short story titled 10 O'Clock People, which is being made into a feature film right now. Your concept is similar, but very unique in that, yes, they live among us, meaning people who look like you and I, but you describe they have a secret ability, which is telepathy. Can you tell me how you got into writing this book?
Well, first of all, Monkeys of Eden is a book I wrote in 1999, and I can guarantee it's only half the picture. It doesn't show how these reptilians use the demonic hive, the alien or Zeta Reticulans or the Greys. It doesn't mention the Greys at all. It's only half the picture. But it's certainly the reptilian half of the picture, but it doesn't mention the Greys. See, in my later writings, I come across you know, how it is actually working. There's a sort of dynamic duo. The Greys are the sort of janitors. They do all the Matrix work, and the janitorial staff and the reptilians. Anyway, it's a much more complicated picture than Monkey's Reading actually illustrates. But having said that, how did I get into it? I mean, I think it was maybe just I was starting to witness things. And then luckily for me, I just seem to have a way of analysing it, which was objective. It's very difficult to be objective when this. If this stuff happens to you, you can only class yourself as subjective. So, I mean, I wouldn't know for sure if I was seeing what I was seeing. In fact, you might find people that are sceptics who'd come across to you and say, well, you know, there's a philosopher called Descartes. That kind of scepticism is based on Descartes. How can we know anything? And, you know, everybody, including witch doctors or psychiatrists or whatever, will say that to you. Mm-hmm. How do you know? How can you know? Mm-hmm. And you say, well, I don't know. It's the very truth. But if there are certain things happening and they're repetitive and the modus operandi, the way it's happening to you is the same, you can start to draw a few conclusions or hypotheses anyway. And then it's something that you'd have to test out and make sure that you could be sure of identifying what it is, you know, prove it. To prove this stuff's very hard. You couldn't say, well, listen, pal, I've seen your liquid black eyes. I know you're Draco. Yeah. And what are they going to say? Go and see a, here's your medication, bye-bye,
yeah,
you know?
Definitely. But you, the one tie-in I noticed, which is interesting, is the creative process. And you're a musician and writer, so you're constantly creating and coming up with ideas, as original as they can be. However, you pointed out that the human aura has a lot of our ideas out in around our aura that can be seen,
yeah,
by certain types. And
yeah,
and they'll just pluck them off the aura like an apple from a tree or something.
That's right. I think that does happen, yeah.
I've not heard this before, and I think I can look back in certain times of my life where I felt that. I sensed something strange going on where it was a melding of ideas and discussion, but also just a harvesting in a way. I thought that premise was really interesting, and I haven't read that before in anyone's work. It connects to these telepathic beings not being very creative. If you're just stealing ideas, something would atrophy eventually.
Yes, possibly.
With our remaining time, Andrew, could you explain how your investigation into the paranormal has led you into a very spiritual life?
Can I call myself very spiritual? Not sure, but I think what I've definitely discovered is that the more attention we pay to dark processes, dark things that are going, you know, the more it gets in our face. I've discovered that. But I also discovered the contradiction of that is that even if you ignore the stuff, it gets in your face anyway. So it's just, there's this dark scenario in the world, and it definitely is out to negate us. And I've just looked at various times in my life where miraculous things have happened to save me from circumstances that could have turned out very badly for me indeed. And these miraculous occurrences that have altered, against all probability, have saved me from all sorts of stuff, all sorts of difficult, dangerous hassles have been bypassed by some miracle. I thought, well, my goodness, look at this.
Mm-hmm.
Prayers really are and can be answered, and healing can take place, and prayer does help you turn the other cheek to this stuff. This stuff always wants to engage you and to suck at you and drag you down into its quagmire. But I discovered the meaning of turning the other cheek. You turn your eyes up to heaven, heavenward, and you're actually ignoring this. You're refusing to agree to be in its time space. you're refusing to engage with it. You're refusing to accept it, to agree with it. You're agreeing with a higher reality instead. This turning the other cheek thing is, I don't know, it seemed to strike a chord with me, and I really realized that just how much help I'd been getting, angelic help, spiritual help, whatever you want to call it, it was happening, and I was very, very pleased about that, very grateful. That's not to say that when I started going to church, that the things just stopped happening to me. I think that I've shaken hands with a few scaly hands, scaly clawy hands in church. Let me put it to you, and mm-hmm. I've seen some all sorts of very strange things happening, glowing orbs flying about in church and all that sort of thing as well. I've seen all this as well. And I think to myself, well, you know, obviously we just have to, because church isn't necessarily the answer. It's what's in our heart. What's in our it's a different thing. For me, I'm not a church person. I believe myself to have a contract with Christ. I'm a Christian, of course, but I believe that idea is the thing that's kept me safe where I could have, you know, stumbled by the wayside many occasions. I mean, Mama could have said yes in that strange fishy place in Scotland, or if that young lady from Eastern Europe had kept up her intense flooding my pleasure senses, you know, things could have been different, but they weren't, and I think I'm very glad to have been protected through all of that.
Yes.
Definitely.
I see that there has been significant protection, it seems, for you, and when you're investigating this area, you're going to need it. And that's great, because it seems that you can continue to investigate and find out more information with protection. And it's been a delight to speak with you and scratch the surface of some of the work that you have been doing for quite a while. And if listeners want to find out more information, what can they do?
I'm very findable on the net. Andrew Hennessy. You'll find me on Google, most places. You'll find my websites under Scottish Andrew, and find all sorts of other stuff as well under Scottish Andrew. So they're very contactable, and if you've got any questions, you're more than welcome to get in touch.
Andrew Hennessy, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information on the guests or to leave a comment. I'd like to say a big thank you to Keith Rowland for bringing In Other News onto the Dark Matter Radio Network. It's really an honor to be on this network with other fantastic hosts and radio shows. And I can't wait for Art Bell to come back in July. That's coming up as well. But thank you, Dark Matter Radio.